It's looking at Palestinians themselves and how, when they, like, even there are all these moments throughout the genocide, when it was at its worst, where you would see the most horrific footage and image, like you just didn't think that was possible. And you would still see like Palestinians emerge from that rubble holding the remnants of their loved ones and say things like, God is still great. Like, God is greater than this. We will build, we will continue. And it's like, well, if they who are facing the worst that another human being can inflict on you, what is my excuse to sit here in my apartment, on my phone, on my laptop, as a as an outsider witness, but also as someone who's complicit in their as a taxpayer in the United States, right? And be like, oh, I'm so sad, and I'm going to take pity on them, and oh, despair, and this and that. Like, what's my excuse to feel despair if the people who are picking up the pieces of their loved ones and their lives from under the rubble are like, no, we'll rebuild.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop, a weekly show where we break down the biggest headlines so you don't have to doom scroll. Then we'll dig deeper into something juicy that you should know about. In this episode, we've got Sana Saeed on the show. She's an award-winning media critic who spent a decade working as a correspondent and senior producer for AJ+. And we're going to be talking about Mahmoud Khalil, Gaza, and the genocide. But first, the news. In this week's roundup, we will, as we always seem to have to these days, be talking about tariffs and annexation. But Canada is also getting a new prime minister. In fact, by the time you're listening to this, we'll already have one. Elon Musk is having a very hard time with all of his companies these days, which is hilarious. The US is finally throwing Ukraine a bit of a bone after abusing its leadership in front of the world while kissing Russian ass. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is remaking the Department of Education and the Environmental Protection Agency. And while the former is bad for America, the latter is bad for the world. And lastly, we'll talk about the horrific violations of Mahmoud Khalil's freedom of speech. Let's dive in. The trade war between Canada and the US is still going strong, with both countries lobbing surcharges on the goods that flow between us. As always, this is a story that's constantly changing, so the information I'm telling you now might be outdated by the time you're listening to this. But as things stand now, Canada has slapped counter tariffs on an additional $29.8 billion worth of US goods. That's on top of the first wave of counter tariffs Canada tossed at the US last week, which hit $30 billion worth of US products. This latest set of counter tariffs comes after Trump hit our steel and aluminum industries with a 25% tariff on Wednesday, which he did after last week imposing and removing 25% tariffs on basically all Canadian goods and 10% tariffs on our energy. The chaotic moves have jerked us around so much that The Onion wrote a very funny myth versus fact piece on the tariffs, declaring that the news of 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico is, quote, true. No, wait, it's a myth now. And no, wait. That basically summarizes this entire story better than I ever could. Oh, and Ford also imposed and suspended a levy on US-bound electricity, so that also happened in the last week. Meanwhile, the big bad shadow looming over all of this is Trump's continued threat that he's going to annex our country. This week, he once again called our border an artificially drawn line, which was super reassuring, all while he continued to fantasize about annexing us. Take a listen.
Canada would be great as our cherished 51st state. You wouldn't have to worry about borders. You wouldn't have to worry about anything. And by the way, when you take away that artificial line that looks like it was done with a ruler, yeah. And that's what it was. Some guy sat there years ago and they said, rah. Well, when you take away that and you look at that beautiful formation of Canada and the United States, there is no place anywhere in the world that looks like that.
Yeah. The New York Times also reported this week that Trump challenged the border treaty between our two countries in a call with Justin Trudeau in early February. Specifically, they reported Trump told Trudeau that he, quote, did not believe that the treaty that demarcates the border between the two countries was valid and that he wants to revise the boundary. He offered no further explanation. The treaty he was talking about? Yeah, it's from 1908, which makes me want to know who told him about it. There's no way he already knew about it. Stop giving him ideas. Apparently, during that same call, Trump also took issue with the agreement that we have on the sharing of our lakes and rivers. Thanks, I hate it all. Obviously, Mark Carney and every other Canadian leader has made it extremely clear that the idea of Canada becoming the 51st state is a non-starter. And Canadians are furious. We're boycotting U.S. goods and we've been canceling trips to the U.S. So overall, this musing from Trump, it's been a great success, huh? Anyway, speaking of Canada, we got a new prime minister. Mark Carney is being sworn in Friday morning, which means that by the time you're listening to this, it's probably already happened. This marks the end of the Justin Trudeau mania era and marks the beginning of the Carney craze, baby. Mark Carney, who has previously served as governor of the Bank of Canada and of the Bank of England, has a serious background in economics, which is probably part of why Pierre Poilievre, a career politician, has been shaken in his little boots, leading to very funny posts like this one, in which he claims, Mark Carney has nothing but slogans. I have a plan to put Canada first. Capitalizing the word first and totally failing to see the hilarity of dropping a slogan immediately after accusing Carney of having nothing but. Now, Carney is a pretty centrist dude, and he's expected to have a much smaller cabinet than the one Trudeau had, chopping things down to 20 or fewer ministers compared to Trudeau's 37. Though, by the time you're listening to this, you probably already know who's in Carney's cabinet, so I'm not going to waste too much time summarizing the speculation. Although Carney has already made one controversial pick. He selected Marco Mendicino, a former Liberal MP, as his chief of staff for the transition period. It's apparently a temporary role, but Mendicino has really gone off the deep end since October 7th. Like, he's repeatedly refused to support calls for a ceasefire. And his pinned post on Twitter says that calling Zionists racist is, quote, hate speech. So take from that what you will. However, Mark Carney has at least spoken out about Israel's denial of humanitarian aid and electricity to Gaza, which is better than nothing, although he still didn't name Israel as being responsible for those actions, of course. Meanwhile, Trudeau decided to hit an own goal on his way out of office after his response to Trump had actually made him pretty popular again. In his final days as prime minister, Trudeau decided to loudly proclaim, quote, I am a Zionist.
No one in Canada should ever be afraid to call themselves a Zionist. I am a Zionist.
This, understandably, given Israel has been found to be committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, really upset a lot of people. So it's time for a new era, and we'll see what Mark Carney brings to the table. One thing he'll almost definitely bring, likely before my next podcast episode comes out, is an election. A lot of reporting has suggested that Carney intends to call an election after being sworn in so he can make sure he has a broader mandate from the Canadian people. So we could be voting in the next Canadian government as soon as late April or early May. And according to polling that came out this week from Léger, that's going to be a tight race. They're currently predicting the Liberals and Conservatives are basically tied. So things are getting exciting. Meanwhile, on Thursday, as Carney was putting the final touches on his cabinet, the G7 foreign ministers met in Quebec, where Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio apparently chatted about U.S. tariffs and a potential ceasefire in Ukraine. See, the U.S., after ambushing Zelensky in an embarrassing display in the Oval Office, seems to have softened slightly to the country again. This week, the U.S. lifted its suspension of military aid and intelligence sharing for Ukraine as Kyiv signaled it's open to a 30-day ceasefire deal. However, Putin has already said that while he's apparently in favor of the deal, there are nuances. He said the deal must lead to long-term peace, which means eliminating the, quote, root causes of the crisis. So I guess we'll have to wait and see exactly what he means by that. Because his country is the one that started the entire thing, despite what Trump might try to tell us all. But in the meantime, the violence continues, including Russia bombing Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown. Something he did during the pause of U.S. intelligence sharing with Ukraine. And Ukraine also hit back with a bombardment of Moscow. Shifting gears to something a little lighter, it was a really, really bad week for Elon Musk and several of his companies. This week, his Starship rocket exploded after liftoff, which forced the FAA to issue ground stops at several Florida airports as debris lit up the night sky. Meanwhile, Twitter had a massive outage this week, which Elon Musk blamed on Ukraine, a claim that people who actually understand cybersecurity said was basically garbage. As for Tesla, its stock price has been declining fast, to the point that JP Morgan analysts said it could be one for the history books, with about 48% of Tesla's market cap wiped out in a matter of months. To try to help boost sales, Trump did a weird little Tesla pitch on the White House driveway, showing off Tesla cars alongside Musk and even promising to purchase one. Honestly, the White House effectively becoming a Tesla showroom and police across the country protecting car dealerships from protesters really lays bare what the American establishment is like all about, doesn't it? Speaking of the priorities of the American establishment, this week they kicked off plans to absolutely decimate two really important parts of the government, the Department of Education and the Environmental Protection Agency. On the education front, they're making major cuts, axing nearly half of all department staff as the administration works towards its promise of getting rid of the Department of Education altogether, a move that would directly challenge the authority of Congress, so we'll see how that plays out. So far, the cuts decimated the department's civil rights office, which has left discrimination cases in limbo. According to AP, this includes, quote, families trying to get school services for students with disabilities, allegations of bias related to race and religion, and complaints over sexual violence at schools and college campuses. The cuts have also impacted staffers who handled the federal student loan portfolio, and I really hope the last person out of the door there does the most iconic possible thing. Meanwhile, the EPA is closing all of its environmental justice offices, which were designed to ease the heavy pollution faced by poor and minority communities. I guess preventing environmental racism was just too DEI, so poor folks and people of color just get to suffer. Really great stuff. On top of that, Trump made a bunch of pronouncements on Wednesday that repealed the USA's most significant environmental regulations, including the legal basis that allows it to regulate the greenhouse gases that are heating the planet. And because climate disasters and climate change don't really give a shit about those artificially drawn lines that Trump is so keen to erase, this is going to impact all of us. Fantastic. Thanks again, American voters, for dragging us all down with you. The last story I want to mention today is the detention of Mahmoud Khalil, who was a lead organizer of the protests at Columbia University over Israel's genocide in Gaza. Despite being a legal permanent resident with a green card, he was arrested by the Department of Homeland Security in New York on Saturday and is being held in Louisiana without charge, with the Trump administration claiming that he is somehow a threat to U.S. foreign policy. On Thursday, almost 100 people were arrested at a protest defending Khalil that occupied Trump Tower in New York. The demonstrators, led by Jewish Voice for Peace, demanded the release of the Palestinian activist. That's the news from this week. We'll be going deeper into this story after the break, when award-winning media critic and journalist Sana Saeed joins us to talk about Khalil's detention, Palestine, and the blowback activists face for speaking out against what Amnesty International and a UN special committee have confirmed is a genocide. We'll be right back. Mahmoud Khalil, a key figure in anti-genocide protests at Columbia University, returned home from an iftar dinner with his pregnant wife on Saturday evening. They were immediately approached by agents from the Department of Homeland Security, who shoved their way into the building and demanded Khalil's arrest. The agents informed Khalil's lawyer, who was immediately called, that his student visa was being revoked. But Khalil wasn't on a student visa. He is a lawful permanent resident of the United States with a green card. And now he's being detained in a Louisiana detention center. Authorities are pushing to revoke his green card, and all of this is happening with zero stated evidence of a crime. All the DHS has said is that he has, quote, led activities aligned to Hamas. Whatever the fuck that means. Meanwhile, Israel is withholding aid from a starving Gaza, a move that sure seems like it violates the Geneva Conventions, and politicians continue to gaslight us all, including most recently outgoing Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who loudly proclaimed, quote, I am a Zionist.
No one in Canada should ever be afraid to call themselves a Zionist. I am a Zionist.
To help us make sense of all of this, I am so thrilled to have Sana Saeed on the show. She's an award-winning media critic who spent a decade working as a correspondent and senior producer for AJ Plus. She's based in the United States and has been for most of her life, but I am very proud to claim this badass, incredibly smart journalist as one of us. She's actually Canadian. Sana, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, I am a Canadian, which always surprises a lot of people. But I'm like,
well, I'm very glad to hear it. You're on our side in the Canada-US war, so we won't have to kill each other.
Paris, I'm a full-blooded Canadian, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So I did want to ask you, I mean, what is the mood like in the United States right now following Mahmoud Khalil's arrest? What kind of precedent is this setting? Is it having a chilling effect?
So it's really interesting being, it really depends where you are in the United States. So I am based on the East Coast. I'm in Washington, D.C. So when you're in the heart of the empire, it is a very, very, very different experience that you're having, because you're not just seeing this on your screens in terms of whether it's this story or any of the other stories that have been happening, especially since January 20th. But you're seeing it all play out in your streets as well. Regarding the chilling effect, I don't think there's been a chilling effect to the extent that perhaps this administration and many elected officials, not just in the Republican Party, but even the Democratic Party, would want there to be a chilling effect. Because there's still Americans, there's still, non-Americans, there's still Muslims and Arabs who, including students, countless students, who are going into the streets, whether in New York, in D.C., or elsewhere in the country, and protesting against what seems to be the unlawful detainment of a U.S. permanent resident, Mahmoud Khalil, over what is becoming increasingly obvious is his speech, specifically his anti-genocide speech. Although I have not yet seen really any type of clarification made by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, which we now know he's the one who was like, it was his decision to revoke the green card, even though under U.S. law, the only person who can actually revoke a green card is an immigration judge. So there does seem like there's a bit of overreach there. But, but does that mean anything anymore? Who knows? Like, that's what it's like living in the U.S. What does the law actually mean?
That sounds so fun.
It's amazing, yeah. Because you try to, you're like, oh, let me appeal to the law. And you're like, but what does that even mean? Like, yeah. What does it mean to appeal to the law when literally anything goes? You have someone like Marco Rubio who has said himself, as well as other White House officials, have said that the reason why Mahmoud Khalil was detained and had his green card revoked is because he was determined to be a threat to national security. And they keep making references to his speech. I mean, we had the head of DHS, Homan, even say, like, well, there is a limit. Today he said there's a limit to speech. But they don't specify what speech it is that they're discussing as well. And that's really, really concerning. I mean, this is going to have far-reaching consequences for I think, first and foremost, for Arab and Muslim students. We saw that Canary Mission, which is, if you're not familiar with it, if your audience is not familiar with it, it is an awful website that's been around for almost a decade. And what it does is that it creates an inventory of people who work in academia or even journalists such as myself. I'm on there. And it basically creates little profiles of us and says like we're all supporters of terrorism, we're anti-Semites, so on and so forth. It's a very shady organization in terms of who's behind it, the money behind it and whatnot. But that organization, Canary Mission, is one of several pro-Israel groups that we know is directly linked to not only the persecution and detainment and pending deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, but also of five other Columbia students and professors, right? So Canary Mission just released a press release yesterday, as well as a video saying that we've identified five others, and four of the five are people who are of Arab and Muslim backgrounds. So that's going to be the group that's going to be first and foremost impacted by this. But it's going to have reverberations beyond, and especially with this administration, which has shown that it has no interest in the protection of anyone's speech, anyone who is seen as providing a narrative that is antithetical to the one that they want to push as well. So we are in absolutely a full-blown McCarthy era in this country once again.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Canary Mission, because I actually wanted to talk about the role of these groups that have spent the last, you know, more than the last few years. Like it's been a lot of this kind of thing has been going on for a long time. Misrepresenting folks who oppose atrocities in Palestine as somehow anti-Semitic or aligned with terrorism. It seems to me like the folks making those kinds of claims have put people in very real danger. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what they're doing and the impact that they have?
Absolutely. The Canary Mission, its kind of main goal is to make you unemployable. Right? That's always been the goal. And we've heard of so many stories of especially students who've been put on there struggling to find work. I had a really good friend of mine, a former colleague, who, after he left the company, he was looking for work elsewhere and he got a job. But he asked them at some point, because he was concerned about his Canary Mission profile, he asked, you know, did you guys come across my Canary Mission profile? And they said, yes, we did. And it was a conversation we had. Even though if you actually look through the profiles that Canary Mission creates, mine, for example, I'm going to talk about mine. Please don't visit it because it does help the SEO too much.
Oh, no.
But I also will say so there's a joke about Canary Mission that like, it's like a really good repository of hot people. So if you're like looking for someone, but so they use beautiful photos for everyone. And for me, they use screenshots of where I'm making, because I'm very expressive when I speak. And so I've gotten a little better at controlling it on camera. But back in the day, I did not control it on camera. And so they have these like screenshots of me making ugly faces. And I was like, you know what? You guys are super fascist, but you have a sense of humor. Whoever made my profile was like, we're going to make sure she looks ugly as hell. but my profile, it has like all these claims like, oh, Sana supports, this terrorist action and this and that. And they hyperlink it. And the assumption is that you're not actually going to click that hyperlink, that you're just going to read this and you're not actually going to click on the things that they're referencing. The way that they're able to get away with any of this is because, first of all, defamation laws in the United States are very, very strict. So in order to prove defamation, it's extremely hard. So they can easily say, well, that's our interpretation. And so many of the hyperlinks I have on my page are to tweets that are A, part of a thread, and they just took one, ignoring the rest. Two, they're literally jokes. Right? They're jokes referencing, it's like from 2012, 2013, where I was like a super troll on Twitter. And so like they reference that. And then you actually read the context and you're like, what are they talking about? But they do this in order to make you unemployable, make you an unsavory candidate for any kind of workplace. And it has been unfortunately detrimental to a lot of people, especially really young people. And again, the majority of people who are targeted by Canary Mission, just like by organizations like Beitar, which is this one of the oldest Zionist organizations in the world. Israeli prime ministers have gone through it. Other Israeli elected officials have gone through it. Beitar, or even, you know, the Columbia Jewish Association of Alumni, the people that they primarily, or the ADL, right? The people that they primarily are targeting are, again, Arabs and Muslims. Right. So this is not like, yes, there are other people, absolutely, including a lot of Jews, a lot of anti-Zionist Jews who are also in the crosshairs. But when we look at the demographic that is overwhelmingly represented in the crosshairs of these organizations, it's Arabs and Muslims. And for them, whatever they have said, whether it's like, oh, that wasn't a great thing to say, or that was clearly taken out of context, it doesn't matter, because the way that biases work is not going to be obviously in their favor as well. They, Arabs and Muslims in particular, like, we're not going to be given the benefit of the doubt when it comes to our words and how they're construed, especially if they're critiquing things like occupation, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and genocide.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you mentioned the ADL as well, because I'm not sure if you saw their statement on Mahmoud Khalil's arrest. What did you think of that? And what do you think of the direction that the ADL, I mean, it's kind of always had this undercurrent, which I was really grateful to Sarah Hagi actually first tip me off to the fact that they might not be the most reliable source after all. You know, what did you think when you saw their response to his arrest?
It was like the least surprising thing ever. I mean, under Jonathan Greenblatt, the ADL has gone even more extreme. In fact, actually, the one thing that I do appreciate about Greenblatt is that he kind of took the entire mask off of what the organization's real function is, which is not to actually combat real anti-Semitism in this country. And we saw people, we saw even out in following October 7th, a few people who were working at the ADL leave because they were saying like, hey, we know that the largest threat to Jewish Americans in this country is coming from white supremacists. But we're being told, hey, actually, it's these like students when kafias who are saying from the river to the sea, those are the real threats to Jewish safety, so on and so forth. But I think the ADL, I mean, it's truly a very nefarious organization, because it takes something which has a very long cultural memory in the United States, right? For a lot of Americans, and especially white Americans, the history of World War II, the history of the Holocaust, and the lessons of the Holocaust, and the lessons of anti-Semitism, that's not a thing of the past. That's something that is constantly reiterated in our pop culture, in our education, again and again and again. And so what the ADL does, it takes that cultural memory and infuses it with like what's happening right now in the country, and creates a narrative, which is actually very easy for, I think, many Americans, although I don't know if most Americans, to kind of fall into, which is like, oh yes, the real threat to Jewish Americans are these kids, are these, you know, these women in hijabs, these boys with beards, these people who wear, these other Jews who wear kafias. That's the real threat. And I think the ADL, what it's doing, much like a lot of these Zionist organizations, and specifically Jewish Zionist organizations, is, you know, I'm not interested in, like, especially in this moment as Palestinians are facing, you know, continued genocide, as we see Islamophobia at really insane levels. We've seen Palestinians who are Arab and Muslim in this country killed and attacked over their physical safety. I'm not interested in this context for, like, centering, you know, Jewish Americans. But what these organizations are doing is setting up a very dangerous situation for their own community, right? Especially when they refuse to, they absolutely refuse to separate, and they have no interest in separating, and that's a different conversation, separating their identity, their community's identity as a Jewish community from the state of Israel, and not just from the state of Israel, but from everything that the state of Israel does. So that's what groups like the ADL and all these other Zionist groups, and specifically Jewish Zionist groups, are doing. Not only are they putting my communities at risk, putting them in the crosshairs of state violence while defending, you know, the state violence against Palestinian children, right? So for over 17, 18 months at this point. I mean, even it goes obviously to 8 decades, but especially the last 17 months. Not only are they doing that, but they're putting their own community in the crosshairs of white supremacists, right? And also, there are going to be a lot of people right now, and this is a conversation I've had time and time again, right? I try to explain to people how this trope of, the Jews control everything, right? That's like something you hear again, and it's a very, very famous anti-Semitic trope. And you hear it a lot more these days because you see the undue level of influence that groups like the ADL and others are having on policy, domestic policy in particular, and the safety of all students as well, and how they're weaponizing an experience of their communities against other communities, right? So we're seeing even people who maybe don't have or never, like I've seen, I'll say it. I've seen people from all different backgrounds who don't have any kind of, prior to this, had no kind of, negative inclination towards the Jewish community. And they're seeing these things that are being said by people who say we are representatives of the Jewish community. And they see, 80% of American Jews identify as Zionist, as pro-Israel. They're seeing these things. And they themselves are now coming, unfortunately, to these conclusions, which, again, bolstered by these Jewish Zionist organizations, are going to have a detrimental impact on the safety and I think also the cohesion of the Jewish American community.
The number of Jewish Americans who are actually Zionists, I believe that there's been quite a bit of debate over the validity of the figures claiming that level is that high. And the conflation of Zionism with Judaism then creates this situation where people think that they should be criticized or create these narratives about what they claim or describe as Jewish groups that are in effect just Zionist groups. And, anyone can have that ideology, as we saw. Justin Trudeau just came out and loudly proclaimed, "I am a Zionist," in his last few days in power.
I mean, the most influential Zionist of the last several decades was Joe Biden, right? This Catholic guy. Yeah. He was, and that's why I tell people, I'm like, the most, in terms of that genocide could have stopped had he been like, "We're done." Yeah. We're going to threat. It takes one phone call to do it. Right. And that's what I mean, is that facts do point us in a different direction. Even like that 80%, that 80% is a specific age group. We find that when you break down the numbers, the younger American Jews are, obviously, the less Zionist they are as well, because there's been a break in the community. You have Justin Trudeau. Which, by the way, it's so crazy to me. He's on his way out.
I know. And people were liking him again.
I'm like, hey, yeah. Which is crazy, because I'm like, so why did you say, do you actually believe, like, and which is actually crazier to me, that if you actually believe that on his way out within the last week, he didn't say anything about the fact that Israel had cut off water and electricity into Gaza again. That happened while he was still in office. He found time to call himself a Zionist, found time to talk about, we stand with Zelensky and with Ukraine, etc. Zero time to talk about the fact that Israel, and I do think it's interesting. I mean, I'm never going to give the liberals flowers, but I think it's very interesting that one of the first things I see Carney say was, he comes in as like the new leader of the Liberal Party and kind of the prime minister designate, is that he tweets out about like water and electricity being cut off to Palestinians in Gaza, although he doesn't say who does it, which is usually how they get away with it.
Yeah.
But, I'm like, Trudeau, like, you really are just insufferable, like on a personal level. Not even just like, it's like if he was running, I'm like, okay, he's clearly trying to shill. It's like, no, he's free and he's still like, yes, I'm a Zionist. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, again, like, just and just the characterization of it and stuff, being like, no one should be afraid to call themselves a Zionist. I actually do think that people should be prepared to face backlash and people criticizing them if they characterize themselves specifically as a Zionist right now. The distinction there is, no one should be afraid to call themselves Jewish. And that is what needs to be protected and who needs to be protected. You shouldn't have to defend an ideology. You should be defending people and religious groups. So I don't know. It's disappointing. And, I did want to ask you, I mean, why do you think Western countries like Canada and the U.S. have made it so rhetorically risky to be supportive of Palestinians when they are so clearly dealing with egregious human rights violations. I mean, it really, when you actually pay attention and look at the UN figures and look at all of the experiences of every single person who's ever traveled to that region, it's really clear that something horrifying has been going on there for a very long time. And it doesn't make sense to me that it's so risky to point that out and to try to defend vulnerable people who are being hurt and are now being subject to a genocide. Why do you think this is the case?
I think there are multiple reasons. I do think a huge part of it is like just latent racism as well. Yeah. Like the fact that, people will look at, especially in these Western countries, they look at Israelis as an extension also, right, of like Western civilization. I mean, when you repeat again and again and again, the only democracy in the Middle East, oh, they're just like us, they're just like us. And they're surrounded by a sea of these like bloodthirsty Arabs and Muslims. And we're talking about countries which have also built in the last 20 years, their entire security apparatuses, national security apparatuses, by demonizing and criminalizing like Muslims and Arabs. And their practice and what they look like, what they wear. I mean, these are conversations in Canada we have all the time, right? I mean, Quebec, right, has been home to, should Muslim women wear hijab or niqab or this or that? I was in high school when that conversation started. I was 15 or 16 years old when that started in Quebec, and they still once in a while are like, wait a second, should they?
Oh, like, all the time,
so,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, like, the yeah. Quebec are like, hold on. So I think there's that element to it, which is that they see Israelis as an extension of their, I mean, and it is, right? Israel is an extension of like Western European colonization as well. So that is a very much so that through line that needs to be recognized. I also think a lot of it has to do with the really incredible, I don't mean incredible in a positive way, but it's really like, I would say awesome, and I don't mean awesome in a positive way. I mean in like the literal sense of the word, like to inspire awe. But the awesome lobbying effort by pro-Israel groups, especially since the 1980s. One of the big things that happened in the 1980s when you had Israel get involved with the, start bombing Beirut, it was involved in the Lebanese Civil War, was that it was for the first time. And we had, of course, the Sabra Shatila massacre, where Israeli troops oversaw Lebanese phalangist troops, who were Christian Maronite, go into the Palestinian refugee camps and just slaughter people left and right. When these images came out, it was the first time that, for instance, a lot of Americans were seeing these type of images. It was the first time that Palestinians, that Arabs and Muslims were seen as actual victims versus what we saw post, you know, World War II, where Jews, where the Israeli was like the one who was trying to build his country in the shadows of, in the aftermath of the Nazi Holocaust, of Nazism. And so we see this kind of, if you actually watch the news coverage from the 1980s, you see that even reporters start taking kind of a really harsher tone with Israeli commandos. The Israeli commando goes from being like this hero, this pioneer who's fighting for his land, to, is he killing children? Is that what he's doing? And it's around the same time, I mean, there's that famous story of how, I mean, Reagan goes and makes an address and says, this has got to stop. And he famously said, again, never to give credit to Reagan, but this always shocks me because we know who Reagan is and what he did and what his legacy is. But he says, like, the answer to killing children is not killing more children, right? After, I believe it was the Sabra Shatila massacre. And he calls up the Israeli prime minister and says, you need to put an end to this right now. And he called what they were doing, what the Israelis were doing in Lebanon, a Holocaust. That was the language. And that was a language that was used in the 1980s, which is not that long after the Nazi Holocaust, right? Now, what we see also happen in the 1980s is that as pro-Israel groups in the United States see this, they see that, hold on a second, are you guys turning on us? Are you saying that our state can't do the thing that it needs to do? It starts investing a lot more in lobbying efforts, right? And that's why we see the proliferation of groups like not just AIPAC, but we see also CAMRA. CAMRA, which is famously like very heavily involved in essentially bullying newsrooms in their coverage of Palestinians and their coverage of Israel and their coverage of Israel. You don't hear about it as much anymore, but it's very active. And I've heard journalists in the last year talk about how they still are afraid of CAMRA sending a letter to their employer, CAMRA petitioning to get them fired.
Well, we have that in Canada too with them. Yeah. There's a group called Honest Reporting that has gone after several of my friends who are incredible journalists, just
they
absolutely really? Oh my God.
And it's so weird. I was giving a talk. I was set to give a talk at McGill University in October. And this was like where it got really weird. So they start sending out emails and they start sending out, including emails to the administration. And I knew they were doing that because there were several McGill administrators that were checking my LinkedIn. And I was like, oh God. So and there was also like the event was supposed to be in person. But there was a threat that was received, which is, it's so like common. They'll call or email and threaten a bomb attack or something like that. So the event was moved completely online. It ended up working out, but they had this article on me and calling me like a raging anti-Semite, et cetera. But here's the weird thing. Here's like the weirdest thing. It was a photo. They took a photo of me and you had to like scroll, you had to scroll to 2020 on my Instagram to find that photo. It was me wearing a traditional Pakistani dress. However, it was black with like red flowers. So I think they thought it was a traditional Palestinian dress because usually red and black and like the tatriz threading style that they have, traditional Palestinian. They took that, not only that, but because it was like, it kind of cut me off, they used AI to like essentially, they made me super busty with like the most snatched waist. And I was like,
oh my God.
I was like, thanks for making me look real hot, guys. Appreciate it.
Damn.
Yeah, that's what they did. So that's what Honest Reporting, and it's so funny too. They
little
were tweeting
freaks.
They promoted, I was super free. I was like, this is so creepy. Like,
it's really creepy. Oh my God. I did also want to mention, you highlighted at one point that Mark Carney came out and actually like kind of said something a little bit empathetic towards Palestinians without actually naming the perpetrator. But I wasn't sure if you were aware that he just named his new chief of staff. And it is Marco Mendicino, who has been extremely outspokenly Zionist and who actually even went so far as to say that calling Zionists racist is hate speech and should be a criminal offense. So I think it's just so frustrating. It sometimes feels like there's one step forward and then 10 steps back. And it's all just about trying to recognize the basic humanity of people who deserve to be able to live in peace and not be, you know, starved to death or bombarded. Yeah. It's frustrating.
I'm pretty sure Carney said what he said initially about like the electricity into Gaza, specifically because, I mean, again, he's thinking about the elections.
Yeah.
Right. So he can say like, oh yeah, we, you know, we're like, look, we do recognize that we recognize Palestinian suffering. We recognize Palestinian suffering. Of course, we're never going to recognize who causes the suffering. So yeah, I'm not surprised about that. I'm not surprised about his chief of staff. The liberals are very similar also to the Democrats here in the United States. They see what's going on and they're like, oh, well, oh, you guys want more racism? Okay. Like that's, they're like, oh, you want us to be more right wing? Okay, we'll do that. As opposed to actually really, and they're really right now, right? Like riding off the high of heightened Canadian patriotism and like all Canadians being like, yeah, we're not going to buy American products. It's no longer called Americanos. They're called Canadianos. I saw that. I saw that. You see that video of that barista?
Yeah.
I was like, and so, you know, I think they're kind of riding off that wave and they know they've got, what's his name, Pierre Poilievre right there. So yeah, they're going to try to offset him a bit. The liberals, like the Democrats, run on the assumption that, oh, those quote unquote minorities, right, are going to vote for us anyways.
Yeah.
Right? They kind of run on that assumption. But I mean, the Democrats also have now learned the hard way.
Yeah, and I think that the one upside of seeing people sort of make craven political statements is that that means they can be pressured into having empathy. If they don't genuinely have empathy, they can at least be forced to take more compassionate stances and, pressured into doing so. So, I think that's basically everything I wanted to ask you. I guess, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you feel is important to say on this issue?
I think it's just really important to, I'm one of those people who's not like, okay, it's time to panic. It's time to panic. It's time to panic. But, and what's happening right now to also Mahmoud is not something that also just happened overnight. I think it's so easy, and it is easy, and I'm not taking away the blame, like, on the Trump administration, but I think it's very easy to be like, this is the Trump administration and that's it. But I think what we then easily forget is that this was something that was in the works from October, especially October 2023, right? When the ADL was talking about how it was working to identify foreign students who were sympathetic to Hamas. But even beyond that, we saw the Democrats stand by and support the violent crackdown on anti-genocide student protesters across this country. We saw universities completely bend over backwards to make their pro-Israel donors and elected officials happy. We saw months of conversation and demonization of if the slogan "From the River to the Sea" is a call to genocide, right? Like, we saw months of that. We saw months of how of this conversation on, oh my gosh, what about Jewish student safety on campuses, again and again, which of course was only focused on like a very small subset of Jewish students who are pro-genocide. It was like, that's who we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, Muslim students. We're not talking about Arab students on campus and their safeties. We're not talking about anti-Zionist Jewish students and their safety. So we saw that for over a year play out. And all of that is what leads to then an administration like the Trump administration making this type of a decision.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, absolutely, this is a panic moment. It's a panic moment because of this was, like I said, the landing point. No, it's not the landing point, actually, but it is one of the landing points of what we've seen over the last few years. And the Trump administration is not going to back down. And we've seen that they don't have, of course, much of, they don't really care much for the rule of law. And I mean, neither did the Biden administration. They didn't really care much about the fact that they were breaking their own administrative laws when they were continuing to provide weapons to a country that they knew that they had on record as breaking humanitarian law, right? They broke their own law when they did that. They also broke every single international human rights law as well in the process. So when you create that kind of lawlessness, a culture of lawlessness, and this idea that, well, laws only matter when we want to use them against the people we don't like. This has been in the making for a very, very long time. And now the fruits of that labor are about to, you know, we're about to see that. Yeah. And that's scary. And that's what I mean is like, again, I don't believe in usually just panicking, but this is a moment where I think, especially in the United States, we should be panicking. I don't know what it means in Canada. I mean, there's crazy things that have happened in Canada in the last 16, 17 months. So I would not be surprised, whether it's a liberal or conservative government that we have next, to see parallels.
Yeah. Yeah, we do love our parallels, the worst ideas that come out of the U.S. I know I said that I was pretty much done asking you questions, but when we were just chatting there, I just thought of one last thing I'd like to throw at you, which is, you know, you've been outspoken with your compassion for Palestinians and standing up for them for so long. And I think sometimes it can feel really hard because of the constant wave of accusations that you deal with for having that empathy and, you know, just the attacks on anyone who has any pro-Palestine sentiment or bone in their body. How do you hang on to hope even in moments like this? And what advice do you have for other people out there who are feeling like it's such an uphill battle right now?
I think it's the two things, or there are three things that really helped me kind of find hope. And all three of them are ropes I hold on to in these moments, even though like the dread and despair do overcome me and overwhelm me quite a bit, especially like when you're just watching. And I mean, the thing that I do as a journalist is, you know, I don't report the news. What I like to do is A, critique how the news is told, but also look for patterns and kind of situate those patterns in history. So when that's the way your mind works, when I see a news, you know, breaking news, I'm not thinking about this is just happening right now. I'm thinking about it in the context of like however many years of history. But the three things that I personally use on, I use as kind of those ropes to keep me afloat. One is my faith. Like as a Muslim, my faith is just so, it really, really emphasizes, first of all, not just the like fighting for justice, but also just like the, like despair is so looked down upon. And it's like, you know, so that's one thing. The other thing is, like, it's looking at Palestinians themselves and how when they, like, even there are all these moments throughout the genocide when it was at its worst, where you would see the most horrific footage and image, like you just didn't think that was possible. Like all the different ways in which the human body, the body of a child could be torn apart. And you would still see like Palestinians emerge from that rubble, holding the remnants of their loved ones and say things like, God is still great. Like God is greater than this. We will build, we will continue. And it's like, well, if they, who are facing the worst that another human being can inflict on you, what is my excuse to sit here in my apartment, on my phone, on my laptop, as an outsider witness, but also as someone who's complicit in their as a taxpayer in the United States, right? And be like, oh, I'm so sad and I'm going to take pity on them and, oh, despair and this and that. Like, what's my excuse to feel despair? If the people who are picking up the pieces of their loved ones and their lives from under the rubble are like, no, we'll rebuild, right? That doesn't mean they don't feel pain. I don't want to romanticize Palestinian suffering in any way, but like, what is my excuse at that point to feel despair if Palestinians themselves don't feel despair? And same with like, you know, even like there were so many incredible videos, like South Lebanon was completely decimated by the Israelis. And I saw these incredible videos of like the Lebanese, you know, they'd go and they're like, oh, okay, this is where my house was. I'm going to have a cup of tea here. Like you can't detach us from our land. And when you see a people who are like, these, like, they're so rooted in their land, you're like, you can't defeat those people. They're so rooted in their land. They're so, they are protecting their culture and their history, their language, their food, everything. No matter, even when they're being starved, they will find a way to create those small things that remind them that are a part of their culture and their heritage. And so when you see that, you're like, why am I feeling defeat for a people that clearly can never be defeated, right? And then the last thing is also just reminding myself that whether it's now or whether it was 60 years ago or 100 years ago or whether it's in the future, the fight for justice is never going to be a happy one. It is one which is grueling. It is very difficult. It is something that will make you doubt the things that you thought you knew. But that is what that fight is about. Because you don't do it for gratification. You don't do it to feel good. You don't do it to make friends. You do it because you're fighting and you're trying to bring attention to what is ultimately just. And that means fighting for something that you may not see within your lifetime. I hope and pray that it's within my lifetime that I can go to a free Palestine, right? A completely free Palestine. But that's not why I fight. I don't fight because I want the free Palestine, because it's going to happen in my lifetime. I fight because justice means like fighting for something that is so difficult and something that you may never be able to actually grasp in your own hands.
That's really beautiful. Like, I was getting emotional while you were describing all of that, and just thinking of people like Mito Halimi, who had his little garden and was growing food in Gaza. Or there's this little girl, I think her name's Renad. She's got an account where she just cooks and makes, and she shows off the food that she makes with the little that she has. And, you know, it's really, I love the sentiment of what's our excuse. You know, so Sana, I think we can probably wrap things up there. But thank you so much for your time today, for sharing your knowledge and your compassion. And it was just a really great conversation. And I appreciate you taking the time. Oh, my God. And you need to tell people where they can find you so that they can keep up with your incredible work.
You can find me on, well, you can find me on Substack. And it's called Views My Own, but Substack, which is not super active yet, which is sanasaid.substack. And then you can also find me on Blue Sky with my name, Sana Saeed. You can find me on Twitter, Sana Saeed. And on Instagram, I'm Sana Face. So very easy, S-A-N-A-F-A-C-E. So those are places you can find me right now. I'm working on a few other things. I have a YouTube channel, which I'm hoping I can launch at some point in the next few months. And I also wanted to say, like, thank you, you know, Rachel, for first, like, you know, having me on as a guest, but also like your own commitment to continuing to talk about this story. I think like it's been so disappointing to see Canadian journalists and journalism, I should say, to see Canadian journalism do what it's done. I always tell people that while American journalism has been the worst overall in terms of the actual impact it has on Palestinian life in terms of all the propaganda and whatnot, but it's been Canadian journalism which has been really shocking to me. So thank you for being like one of the few voices in the Canadian news landscape that continues to talk about this issue, even 17 months after it first started.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. That's so kind of you. It's literally the least I can do.
It's
going to be pretty bleak out there. I'm not looking forward to all the response that we'll probably even get to this episode, but fuck them, you know?
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Sana.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Bubble Pop. I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. If you enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing to Bubble Pop on YouTube, Patreon, Substack, and wherever you like to listen. You can also find me on TikTok, Twitch, Instagram, and Blue Sky. I'd like to say a special thank you to Hans Vivian Wenzel for making the incredibly groovy music for Bubble Pop. You can find more of his music on Spotify under the name Hans, lowercase h with an exclamation mark. Thanks again for spending this time with me. Doing this is literally a dream for me, and I could not do that without you. So thank you, and I'll see you next time.